Well, as we are on the brink of a new year, I wonder how many of us have made New Year's resolutions, which I think in and of themselves are not a bad thing. I think resolutions are good and setting goals are good, and I think they can help keep us focused and on track and help keep us productive. Those are good things. But I wonder if we have been thinking that way and you know, have made New Year's resolutions in our minds. I was looking at online to see what are the top resolutions that people are making here in 2018 as they come into 2019. Here where ABC News puts these out. Top resolutions for the upcoming year: exercise and lose weight. No shock there. That's a very common one we hear. Save money, make new friends, get a new job or hobby. Find love, travel. You know, these are very common, not shocking to us probably. What you wish, though, and could you imagine if someone said, my top year New Year's resolution is to know that God is pleased with me. Wouldn't that be a surprise if that's what someone said? If you told that to an unbeliever, no doubt you would get a blank stare from them and they'd kind of look back at you like, that doesn't even register. You know, kind of. Or maybe you might, I mean, I can imagine some, if I said that to some of the people at work, some of them might say, oh, that's a good thing. That's, yeah, you know, why not? That's, you know, we'd all like to know that God's happy with us, I guess, you know, and. But for the Christian, this is a very important and critical question. And it's one of the reasons you became a Christian is because God brought you to a sense of the knowledge of your own sin and His wrath and you feeling the weight of your sin and feeling it upon your own soul, the need to do something with that sin. That God is angry with me. His wrath is upon me. What do I do about that? So we seek to know and to understand as believers, eventually God giving those of us who are believers an understanding that the way of salvation is through Christ and Christ alone, not through any of my own works, not anything I could do to contribute to salvation, but it was of the work of Christ. And giving us eventually, in bringing us to Himself, granting to us that gift of faith. As we exercise that faith, being justified in the sight of God, as we lay hold of Christ and are brought into union with Christ. But I'm not so much this afternoon thinking in terms of justification when I speak about pleasing God or wanting to know that we please God, so much as I'm speaking about sanctification. You know, how we live that out and knowing and being confident that we are living in such a way that God is pleased with. Now certainly, I mean, the Bible goes into great detail about obedience to God and what that looks like, what it is to live a holy life before God. And it's a lifetime of study. You know, for us as Christians, we study the Scriptures our entire lives in seeking to understand and know what God would have for us to do. And yet there are points in Scripture where we have a summary of those things. And it's helpful for us to review and look at them and consider them and remind ourselves of them. And I read recently in my daily Bible reading, Micah chapter 6. And so I came across this passage and it was an encouragement to my own heart as I was thinking on this subject of pleasing God. And thinking about what it just struck me, how here he is speaking to the Israelites. So I'd like to just consider Micah chapter 6, especially verses 7 and 8. And let me read that for you again. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Well, just a bit of context here. In this chapter, God brings an indictment against the people of Israel. If you look back at actually verse 2, he says that very thing. Hear, you mountains, the indictment of the Lord, and you enduring foundations of the earth. For the Lord has an indictment against his people, and he will contend with Israel. The people of Israel had left off the service of God and the love for God, and they were in pursuit of sin. They were in pursuit, if you look down at verse 16, God says that you are following the ways of Omri and Ahab. You're in the pursuit of idols. You're in the pursuit of sin and wickedness. You are not in my ways, despite the fact that I brought you out of Egypt, despite the fact that I rescued you from the house of bondage, despite the fact that I sent before you Moses and Aaron and Miriam to protect you and to care for your soul and to guide you, despite all of that, you have turned away from the Lord. I sent these individuals to you through them, bringing you a law, bringing to you a covenant, bringing to you this matter of assembling together as a nation, as the descendants of Abraham. I set you apart. You were my special people. And this is how you have repaid me. This is how you have treated me. And so, here God brings this indictment against his people. And then, in verse 7, it's as if God is going to answer the thoughts of these men. In other words, if they hear the indictment, they may think, well, okay, so what do I do about that? God is upset and he's angry with me, so what should I do? Well, maybe I should offer sacrifice. That's what I should do. A calf, maybe a year old. I'll offer a sacrifice and maybe rams. We'll offer a lot of rams and maybe that will appease God. Maybe this is a serious sin and God is really, really angry with us and this is going to take something drastic, even tragic. I'll have to offer my firstborn to be sacrificed. Maybe that's what I should do in order to appease God. A very man-centered way of thinking, isn't it? I'll go through these actions. I'll do these things. I'll do penance, as it were. And then God's going to be happy with me. That will satisfy God. We'll be at peace again. The indictment can be removed. The rains will come back. And we're going to have a good harvest. That's what we need to do. And God says, no. No, that isn't what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for outward, formal religion. I'm not looking for people who are cold of heart. God is calling the Israelites to love him, that their hearts should be devoted to him, that their hearts should be set upon him, and not the ways of evil serving idols. And what does God say? You know, what is his desire? If a person really has a heart for him, loves him, and pursues him. And he gives three things here in summary that he says in verse 8. He has told you, he says, O man, what is good? And what does the Lord require of you? I mean, to know that God is pleased with you. What does he call you to do? And if I do these things out of a genuine heart and love for the Lord, he will be pleased with this. It is to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Three things. Now, the scriptures sometimes summarize, sometimes it summarizes it maybe in two laws. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. The scripture gives us summaries like these at times. That's even kind of, you know, if you're thinking of it up-leveled, that would be Christ says on these two, the law and the prophets, hang on those two, right? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. And then this, you could think a little more detail here. And then there are other passages which are more detailed than this. But these three things, overarching categories. Can you imagine if in coming into year 2019, people had this in mind and they thought, I want to know God is pleased with me. I want to honor Him. I want to obey Him. And this is what I'm going to focus on. To do justice, kindness, and to walk humbly before my God. Let's take them each in turn and just consider them. Justice. What do we mean when we speak of justice? Well, we're speaking of equity or equality, being equal. You know, the scales, as it were, being balanced. We oftentimes, if we feel things are awry and we're not being treated the way we want to, we'll say, well, that's not fair. I'm not being treated fairly. This isn't balanced. This isn't right. It's not equitable here, or it's not, you know, it's not going both ways. It's not equal in the same direction. Right? What we're saying, whether we realize it or not, is there's been a miscarriage of justice here. We may not always think about it in terms of that, but that's really what we're saying. We're addressing the idea of justice. Something unjust has happened here. A law, so to speak, has been broken. And it could be a law with respect, it could be a biblical law. It could be something we're talking about on a national level, or you know, you can come right down to a state, county, local, whatever city. We could be thinking of things in terms of that, or maybe even a household law, right? This is a rule that my parents have put in place, and the kids may be thinking, hey, you know, that's mom and dad said this, and you did this, and now that's not fair. You know, it's this statement, in effect, that there has been a miscarriage of justice or a law broken, right? That's what justice has to do with. And God says, you are to be just and fair with one another. You are to treat one another with equity. You are to treat one another with a holy fairness. And there's several ways that, there's many passages we could turn to. I'm going to go to some passages and look at what the scriptures say here about what is the breaking of that, or what is the failed, what's the right word? What is the perversion of justice? What is the miscarriage of justice that God speaks of in the Word? Examples of this, the negative example of being just. Exodus chapter 23, look at verses 1 through 3. We'll spend a little bit of time here. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many, so as to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving it with him. With it, you shall rescue it with him. Down to verse 7 is where I want to end. You shall not pervert the justice due your poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. So here we have in these verses several things that would be unjust, several things that would be a violation of God's command in order to do justice. The first of which is being an evil witness. Someone was not to go before the judge and claim something which was completely false with respect to a fellow Israelite or us about our fellow man. It's not just an Israelite or just people who attend church. We need to be honest, right? That's what God is calling us to, honesty. Not lies. Not bearing false witness. Right? It's one of the Ten Commandments that you shall not bear false witness. You are not to be going about lying about your neighbor before a judge or before anyone else for that matter. You get into issues of slander and gossip. Right? Slander is going about telling falsehoods about people. Gossip is telling stories about people which could be true, but oftentimes contains unverified facts and their stories about one another that aren't anybody else's business, especially if they're true or otherwise. Not just if they're true, but oftentimes gossip is just telling stories that may be true, but it's just no one else's business. That's unjust. He speaks of going before the judge and falling in with the crowd on your decision. In other words, instead of saying, look, if you have several people casting their lot, so to speak, against an individual, and you know that they didn't do it, everybody believes that someone is guilty, for example, and we're using the courtroom and here is the setting, but it's not just that, right? I mean, you could think of this as in terms of, let's say you're at home and the kids are, you know, it's peer pressure. And everybody's saying so-and-so did it. And you know better. You know, well, they didn't do it. I know who did do it. But because you don't want to, you know, be the odd one out, you just go along with everyone. God says, well, that's sinful. That's wicked. You know, I just kind of go along with the crowd. And that he's saying that happens when, you know, even in a courtroom setting. And justice is miscarried. And that's a sin. So you have these, you know, even what seems like the common level, low level, menial, right to the more official. Showing partiality to the poor in a lawsuit. Just because a man is poor doesn't automatically give the stamp of approval that he's right. That's something in our society that really needs to be taken note of. Because, if someone's poor and it looks like they've had a hard life and things are tough for them, they get a pass oftentimes. Hey, he committed that crime, but he's kind of had a rough upbringing. He's had things hard. It's tough. He doesn't have much money. You know, you privileged people, you can do without a little bit, you know, and if you lost out because this guy robbed you or whatever, just because somebody's poor does not give them a pass. And that, of course, goes both ways. Ignoring the poor because they're poor and because you think no one takes note of them is also a sin. That's not just, and it's not right. It's not God-honoring. Taking a bribe, Deuteronomy 16:19, it's a perversion of justice. Gets people to look the other way. Can come in all kinds of forms. Not always cash. Sometimes it's power in various forms. Sinful and wicked in the sight of God. Kindness. To do something positive or helpful or beneficial to someone. It's about being friendly to others, generous and considerate. Helping those in need. Being empathetic to others who are in a state of pain and suffering and seeking to help them and assist them. helping to relieve their difficult circumstances. The Bible talks a lot about the widow and the orphan. James 1:27, this is true religion, to minister to widows and orphans. Talks much about helping the poor and the needy. But kindness is also such things as pure speech, the way that we talk to one another, the way that we interact with one another. Words can be, I'm trying to think of the proverbs, the apples of gold in settings of silver. They can build up. They can heal. They can be very powerful in both directions. They can also be cutting. They can tear down. They can ruin. Solomon said, the wise woman builds up her house and the foolish woman tears it down. If a wife goes about and she's complaining and cutting and quarrelsome, she'll tear her house down. If a man is a tyrant around his house, insulting, degrading, he'll tear it down, he'll ruin it. This is a sin before God. Patience, another form of kindness is to be patient, slow to anger. God is described as being slow to anger. We're to be a people of peace, peacemakers. We are to seek after peace. I wonder how many of us it could be said that that's our attitude. We pursue peace with one another. Or are we irritable, quick to get angry, quick to get upset, not pleasing in the sight of God, not an honor to Him? One of the classic examples in Scripture of kindness is, of course, the Good Samaritan. The parable where this man takes care of someone and who's fallen into the hands of robbers and who has been abused and beaten. And here the Samaritan comes along and he takes care of him, takes care of all of his needs, makes sure that he has what he needs. And even, you know, while he's gone and he just pays for this man's medical needs, whatever, you know, he makes sure that he's taken care of. You have Jesus setting up that whole story to demonstrate to the Pharisees and the Jews how far they fall short of that, how far we fall short of these things. And then humility. Walking humbly before your God. Humility has to do with having a correct thinking about ourselves. It has to do with having proper self-assessment of our skills and abilities. Being willing to take a lower position if necessary, and not needing to push ourselves to the forefront. And by position, I don't just mean some formal position, but even in the, you know, can be things. This is, let's say we're in a conversation with people. Can be something as simple as, I don't need to push myself to the front of the conversation. I'm happy to listen. You know, maybe interject something here and there, but I'm happy not to control the conversation. I always have to be the center of attention. Now, there is such thing as a false humility. That is, pretending not to have either gifts or abilities or downplaying them and kind of almost being self-degrading, as it were. And behaving as if we think, oh, you know, I'm really not that good at this or that, when we actually may be skilled at something. There is a manner in which people almost, it's like they're trying to demonstrate to everybody how humble they are, and really it becomes a matter of pride. My pride is I'm showing everyone how humble I am by things I say which really aren't true. See, Paul talks about in Romans 12, 3 through 8, about judging ourselves soberly. We're to have an accurate view of the gifts that God has given to us and what He has blessed us with, and we're to use them for His glory. And Paul in that passage talks about how the body of Christ, different people have different gifts. You know, some may be elders, some may be deacons, some may get up and speak or assist in public ways. Other people may be very much behind the scenes and supportive, and or they just contribute in various ways. Maybe they have a gift of administrative skills. And they use those for the glory of God. But you see, humility is, it's not prideful just to necessarily recognize, you know, here is how God has worked in my life. Here's the kinds of things I know and understand. And I'm going to use those for His glory. See, that's not prideful. Prideful is going about saying all the things I can do that I really can't do, and how much better I am at everybody else at doing than I'm really not, and just patting myself on the back as if I'm more valuable than anybody else. That would be pride. But to actually recognize, look, God has blessed me in these ways. He's given me an understanding about this and that, and I'm going to use that to His glory. It could be someone who has skills in just repairing things. You know, if you have a church building and someone says, look, I'm going to commit my time to, I'm going to go over there and do some repair work at the church, or I know, you know, this older couple, they need somebody to come over and repair some things at the house, and I'm going to do that. You know, so there's various ways in people that people use their gifts. But it's not prideful for us to get involved and seek to use the gifts that God has given us. And of course, one of the biggest things about humility is to recognize what we are in the sight of God. As we walk humbly with our God, we recognize that I don't deserve any of His mercy, any of His grace. I don't deserve any of that. Anything I have is a gift from God. It is His blessing to me. And to acknowledge God in all of His attributes, to acknowledge Him in all of His character and His being and all of what we know and can comprehend, and seeking to give God glory for who He is. That is certainly the greatest matter of humility, that we walk before God acknowledging who He is and acknowledging who we are and acknowledging what He has done on our behalf. As we transition here to think about the Lord's Supper that's before us, what's interesting to me is that all of these things are represented in this table, if you stop and think about it. Justice is represented here. God's justice being executed. God's justice, what is right, sin was dealt with. Sin wasn't just swept under the rug and given a pass. It had to be dealt with. And justice was carried out on that cross for the sake of us, that we could be forgiven. Kindness. What greater thing, kindness, that one should lay down his life for his fellow man. Christ in mercy. Christ in love laid down his life for us. When we were undeserving, when we were unappealing, unattractive, he died for us. Kindness. Humility. Think about him coming to this earth, taking on human flesh. What an incredibly humbling thing for the God of heaven, who has created all things so far above us that we can't comprehend it. Humility coming. Christ obeying the Father. Christ obeying everything that he was called upon to do for us. All of these things here, these three things displayed here right in front of us. If we understand the symbolism, if we understand what really took place on that cross, here they are demonstrated for us. May God bless these things to our hearts as we come now to the table.